Hello, Happy New Year. This is Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high quality continuing professional development for all UK registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. You join me again in Birmingham, this time not at my clinic, but a few miles away in a different part of the city at a community optometry practice. And I'm here because the service that's provided here is actually quite special. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the practice.
Well, it's a lovely practice. I'm looking forward to hearing all about it. In the episode, we'll be discussing dry AMD. Age-related macular degeneration is the most common cause of sight loss in the UK, and the dry form is the most common AMD condition. Dry macular degeneration happens in people over the age of 50 generally, and the impact can vary from a small amount of blur to significantly reduced vision. Dry AMD occurs as the retina ages, when the photoreceptor and retinal pigment epithelial cells begin to degrade. And as the retinal cells die off, they are not replaced, and so the vision gradually worsens over time. Monitoring dry AMD in the community is important so that us clinicians can understand if the condition is progressing to geographic atrophy and to look out for signs of wet AMD, which can affect vision much more rapidly. Today, we'll meet one of Brad's patients to explore how monitoring services can have a positive impact on patient satisfaction and, in some cases, disease outcome. And later on, we'll investigate the next frontier in treatment for dry macular degeneration. Ophthalmologist Claire Bailey will discuss the therapies that will hopefully become available in the UK this year. These could show the potential to slow the progression of the disease much earlier on.
So my name is Brad Warwick. I'm an optometrist working in the National Health Service, and I also own a private specialist optometry practice here in Harborne in Birmingham, seeing patients ranging from core optometry through to some specialisms that I've developed over the last 7 or 8 years. When I started practicing in this particular area, there were a lot of predominantly elderly Caucasian patients that I started to see with dry macular degeneration. I was keen to keep a closer eye on these patients and counsel them to ensure that if there were any changes towards exudative wet macular degeneration, it would be picked up as quickly as possible.
So how do you go about explaining dry AMD to your patients?
Well, I think technology has been a massive aid. Since I started here, I'd routinely dilate new patients that I see and photograph their retinas. And obviously when you're dilating patients, you often see more. And so you often see early changes of dry macular disease. And if you see these things, it seems only right that you talk to the patient about what you're seeing. And I find that photography and obviously optical coherence tomography now that is more widely used is a very powerful tool to describe patients. Yeah. As they say, the photograph says 1,000 words.
So you explain a little bit to them, but then you also show it to them so they can see the impact on how it actually appears compared to a normal eye. And optometrists in practice are very familiar with the signs of AMD, but what do you think are the particular signs or symptoms that make you more suspicious that this particular patient might be progressing or they might progress to wet AMD?
Obviously, the technology is useful. The type of drusen that I'm seeing and how closely packed those drusen are and how they're coalescing. If there's any thinning of the retinal pigment epithelium or geographic atrophic changes are very useful. And I've actually found, you know, formal education, the college's professional certificate in medical retina, I found very useful, which I did 4 or 5 years ago, to get a deeper understanding of dry macular degeneration. And its classification of staging was a really useful tool. And that sort of aided in to this particular clinical service that I offer to feel more confident through additional education on this particular pathology.
As far as risk factors, when you're sort of talking to patients, what are the risk factors that you're sort of on the lookout for?
Well, luckily, all the patients that I see here maintain their health very well. So I don't have too many smokers that I see. But obviously, I counsel them. Look, I think stopping smoking is probably the single most effective lifestyle change to reduce your risk of macular disease development, nutritional supplementation. So I talk about foods that are rich in antioxidants, such as lutein and zeaxanthin. I do recommend supplements for patients that I see with moderate to advanced macular degeneration. And I find the uptake on those is generally quite high. Mm. And patients tend to continue using those long term.
Before people do get to that moderate to advanced stage where you might recommend a supplement, if you were seeing signs of dry AMD, would you recommend making changes to diet beforehand? Because it's not just about adding things in, it's also about removing things out, isn't it?
I do. So I try and say to patients, look, try and reduce your sugar and carbohydrate intake, plenty of leafy vegetables. getting that balance right in life where they're getting a healthy level of exercise and movement, I think is useful for their overall health.
Yes.
So I talked to them a lot about that.
Yes, because a poor diet, being overweight, are risk factors, aren't they? Yeah. And of course, family history as well.
I, on every patient that I see that comes to the office, I tend to ask about family history of eye disease. And I've got quite a few patients that present actually because of a family history of macular degeneration. Yeah. And that's the reason they've come for a consultation.
So when you see patients in practice who you suspect have got significant, or you found to have significant AMD, how do you manage them? How do you monitor them?
So I see them fairly regularly, typically on a 6-monthly basis. I'll always do a refraction to get a good idea of their best corrected visual acuity. I record their visual acuity in LogMAR. So at each interval when I see them, I've got a very accurate idea of whether the vision is changing. Mm. So I like a letter by letter scoring system. I still check for distortion on Amsler grid. I used to use it a lot before I had an OCT. But if a patient talks about changes in symptoms, I'll often use an Amsler grid still with their best corrected near visual refraction in place. Mm. I'll always dilate patients that I see with the macular monitoring. And luckily, I've got a technology that allows me to far more confidently see and detect changes of macular disease and progression, and also clinical signs suggestive of exudative macular degeneration as well.
Just gives you that little bit more confidence, doesn't it? So now's probably a good time to bring in one of your patients. Martin, you've been sitting very patiently in the room with us, so thank you for joining us, Martin.
You're welcome.
So when did you first notice that something wasn't quite right with your eyes?
I suppose 4 or 5 years ago, I couldn't read properly. You know, the letters became somewhat blurred.
And was that for just close-up reading, or was it for distance reading as well?
At first, it was sort of shop letters. Mm. You know, the optometrist I was with was on a high street, and I could see the shops over the road.
Yeah.
And I had great difficulty reading the large letters. And then slowly, it was a small print became a problem.
Mm-hmm. And what did it feel like for you? Because quite often when your vision is blurred, very commonly people do notice the vision becomes blurred and they go and see their optometrist and they get a new pair of specs and everything's fine. So how did you feel when you came to see your optometrist and they said, well, actually, there's something else going on here? You know, how did you feel when you got that early diagnosis?
Not very happy, I must admit. But at least I knew what it was.
Yeah.
My previous optometrist had mentioned AMD. He mentioned it was creeping over my sight, but I felt I wasn't getting enough attention on the NHS. So my daughter recommended Bradley, and that's how I came to be here.
Yes. So when you had your first conversation with Brad, what was that like?
Quite enlightening. Quite, you know, he explained it to me exactly what was happening.
Yeah.
So that was very useful. I like to know what's going on.
As we all do, I'm sure. Yes. Well, most of the time, anyway.
Yeah, even if I can't do anything about it, I just have to live with it. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I say blurred eyesight. I mean, I can't see people's faces clearly if they're more than about a yard or so away.
Mm.
But I can see, if I look over the road, it looks reasonably clear, although I can't read a car number plate.
Mm.
It also depends on light. You know, on a bright day, I can see more clearly than I've done it all day. When I start to read books, I can read normal print, preferably bold print, but I need a powerful lamp.
Yes. So it sounds as if you know what your limitations are, and then you've made some adaptations to try and limit the impact of your macular degeneration on what you're trying to do.
Yes.
So
yes.
Good advice from Brad has been really important, hasn't it?
It has, very important.
So can I just come back to Brad? So Brad, what are the key bits of advice that you tend to give to patients like Martin who've got, you know, fairly significant disease?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I think as we stand at present, I can't prescribe anything that's going to reverse or cure their macular degeneration. So I try and optimise the vision they do have. So obviously an up-to-date refractive correction can have quite an impact, and the use of magnification and lighting, and that's discussed. And I'm always happy to play around with near ads in the trial frame and offer trial magnifiers to patients. Using technology to increase the size of print, that's been a real benefit for a lot of patients with the widespread use of tablets now.
Mm.
Now, luckily, most patients have got some ability to electronically magnify quickly, easily and cheaply. Obviously, the counselling to ensure that they present back to me if there's any visual changes, so we can try and detect early wet macular degeneration in its earliest opportunity. Because we do have good provision for anti-VEGF injections now locally where patients can be treated very quickly. So I'm of the mind that we've got these interventions. We need to ensure that patient gets access to it as quickly as possible. Mm. Again, lifestyle changes, ensuring they're maintaining those, and dietary supplementation.
Yes.
Maybe recommend some pills, which were, they seem to have worked.
What have you seen that's made you think, yes, it's worth me carrying on with these supplements?
Well, it doesn't seem to be getting any worse, or at least not rapidly. It's one of those things you can't, let's try it without, let's try it with.
Yes.
It's just a matter of confidence, I think, yeah. A matter of, it's not getting
worse
very fast. Or...
And of course, you did see it get worse at one point.
Yes, yes, it did. It was perhaps earlier on when it first set in. I think the change was more rapid.
Yeah. And Brad, what do you think about supplements? Do you think it's helped to keep Martin's condition in check?
Yeah, so when I first saw Martin, he had very advanced dry AMD in the left eye with significant geographic atrophy and poor reduced visual acuity, but reasonable visual acuity in the right eye. And I think from my point of view, my objective is to do all I can to ensure that that eye remains good. In terms of trying to monitor progression, obviously visual acuity on a logmar I find very useful. On the particular OCT that I have, it can do a drusen count, and it can also measure that drusen on a three-dimensional volume level as well. Mm. And obviously you can look at the scans and photographs subjectively as well.
And that way you can feel confident that what you're recommending is valid and credible.
Yes. As you get more confident and educated on looking at these OCTs, there's certain things you can look at which are hallmarks of very early changes on an exudative level. Mm. Things like subretinal hyperreflective material, for example, that I didn't know anything about until I got seeing these OCT images and started talking with medical retinal specialists. Obviously, it's quite easy to see significant wet changes, but the subtle changes, I think, have come through continued education, talking with specialists, and seeing patients. The OCT is very useful to try and pick up the exudative changes in their early stages, even before the patient presents with reduced vision or distortion.
So I'll just come back to you now, Martin. You're attending Brad's practice on a regular basis for monitoring. Do you find the regular monitoring reassuring, or do you find that all this information is a bit worrying sometimes?
No, I find it very reassuring. I know that if anything starts to go wrong, it'll be picked up, and gives me an idea of if it is getting worse and, you know, how bad. Now, yes. I'd like to know what's going on.
Yes, and if it has remained stable, then at least you feel encouraged that what you're doing to try and halt the progression is actually doing something. It can be quite motivating to keep taking those tablets and to make sure you're still eating those vegetables. Because that's something that people might tend to drop off and be slightly less healthy sometimes. Okay, and Brad, you've given Martin advice on diet and also about supplementation. Mm. So is there anything in particular that you recommend with regards to supplementation?
I mean, I've been using the formulation recommendation from the IREDS 2 trial. Cost can occasionally be prohibitive for patients. You know, you're going to be looking at probably around £200 a year for supplementation. And it's probably for that reason that I try and stratify the patients that I recommend the supplements to, and I tend to reserve it for patients with sort of more moderate or more advanced macular degeneration.
And again, you've got the reassurance that you've got the scientific research evidence to back up your recommendation or your advice. So Martin, you say you like to know what's going on. So is there anything that you do particularly that helps you to understand your condition better, to reassure yourself that you're doing everything you can?
Only listening to Bradley and taking his advice. I don't do internet research, I'm afraid.
No. Have you come across the Macular Society at all?
I have. I'm a member of the Macular Society. Yeah. Yes, I did join that.
Yes. They have lots of resources on their website. Has that helped you at all?
It's just mainly the articles that I've read and given a bit of hope, you know. The research is going on. But
yes.
Of course, research today is sort of 5 or 10 years down the road before you get treatment. So.
Mm. And I was also quite pleasantly surprised when I looked at the Macular Society's website. They actually have webinars for patients as well.
So, they do, yes.
So I think that's a really great resource for patients to tap into.
Yes, it is. I haven't availed myself of that that yet. But,
well, there's some homework for
you. I'm a bit of a technophobe. But,
Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Brad, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Michelle.
Coming up, we'll look at the interventions on the horizon that hope to reduce the rate of dry AMD progression. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month we explore one topic in depth. So if you've got a topic in mind that you'd really like us to cover, or if you've got an interesting case study that you'd like to share, you can email us. The address is podcast@stockitz.info. Next, I'm joined by Claire Bailey. Claire is a consultant ophthalmologist at Bristol Eye Hospital. She also leads the clinical research unit, where she's been involved in clinical trials for macular degeneration treatments, including one of the new therapies for dry AMD that we're about to discuss. Hello, Claire. Thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So Claire, we've just heard from Martin, who is a patient that has got geographic atrophy. So can you tell me a little bit about what geographic atrophy is and how the disease progresses?
So geographic atrophy is where there are loss of cells either in the centre or close to the centre of the retina. And the cells we're talking about really are the retinal pigment epithelium, which is the pigmented layer under the retina, and then the outer part of the retina where the photoreceptors are. So that's the rods and the cones. So the definitions of geographic atrophy really are, there's something called C-RORA, or complete retinal pigment epithelium and outer retinal atrophy. And you have C-RORA if that area of atrophy is at least 250 microns wide. And what you tend to get on the OCT scan is you can see that those layers are missing, and you tend to get a window defect where the light from the scanner kind of transmits down into the choroid. So it can be seen quite nicely on a standard OCT.
So we are able to pick up geographic atrophy on OCT, but up to now, we haven't really been able to offer much in the way of treatments for patients with this condition. But that's about to change, isn't it?
That's right. So there's been enormous amounts of research going on over the last 10 to 20 years into the mechanism of action of the development of geographic atrophy. And it's now known that complement, which is an inflammatory pathway in the body, can play a major role in the development of advanced macular degeneration. So there have been a lot of research studies, and now phase 3 clinical trials have been positive for two drugs, which have now got FDA approval in the USA. So there now are two drugs available for patients with geographic atrophy in the USA to try to slow the rate of progression. It's important to realise that the treatments are not reversing change. It's about trying to slow the rate of ongoing deterioration. But it's a very encouraging sign. That's the first time this has ever happened.
So can you tell me about how these treatments might be administered and what results people might see?
So the treatments are given by intravitreal injections, but they do need to be given regularly. And I think one of the key elements will be deciding who is suitable for the treatment. And there's quite a lot of subtlety to deciding that, really. We also don't yet know whether the UK will approve these drugs and whether NICE will allow treatment. And if so, there might be a subgroup of patients who would be eligible for NHS treatment, and maybe others won't be.
So it's not actually approved yet in the UK, but theoretically, what might that subgroup look like?
Some of the elements are, where is the geographic atrophy? Where is the wear and tear change? The drugs seem to be particularly effective if the wear and tear has not yet involved the centre, because those patches tend to grow faster, you know, slowing that point at which it gets to the centre. It's not expected it will halt it, but if that buys people more time, then that's, you know, well worth achieving. That's why it's been a very popular drug in the US to date. The other thing is that determining someone's own rate of growth might be a really important thing to look at before one considers treatment, because it can vary quite widely between different patients. So there are particular patterns, and we do a test called autofluorescence. It's a sort of in vivo assessment of how healthy the retinal pigment epithelium is. And with those tests, certain features might imply someone's rate of progression might be faster.
So in the trials that have been carried out so far, were any side effects encountered at all?
Yeah, so it's both of the drugs that are now approved in the US. That's pegcetacoplan and avacincaptad pegol. It is known from the trials that they do increase the risk of conversion to wet AMD. So the risk is relatively low in the placebo group, the pretend treatment group. That's about 2.7, 2.8%. But it at least doubles after the first year in the groups being treated. And the rate of conversion is bigger If you were having monthly injections, which some of the patients in the trials did, it was higher in that group than those that had every other month injections. But the patients are going to be being followed anyhow in the clinics with scans, so that one would be expecting to monitor that and catch that early. And if that did happen, then patients would be treated for wet as well as the dry. And that's what's currently happening in the US if that were to occur.
So that's why it's really important to understand the rate of progression for each individual patient before they start treatment, isn't it? Because before they take on this treatment with its known risks, you have to weigh the benefit versus the risk. And if the benefit of treatment outweighs the risk of progression, and we're tracking their progression beforehand, you can then talk to the patient and discuss it carefully with the patient, whether it's the right thing for them.
I totally agree. It's all about careful case selection and also really careful explaining to people what they might benefit from this, because they really need to understand this is not bringing vision back. This is about seeing if we can slow the rate of progression so that in a few years' time, they may still have retained their central vision. So if people have already lost their central vision, then it's very unlikely that they would benefit a lot from the treatment. It might slow the size of the missing patch in the middle. But the key likely people who would really benefit are those perhaps who've already lost central vision in one eye, but have a patch that's away from the centre in the other eye, that's not too close, but close enough that slowing the rate of deterioration can make a big difference. But the patients also would have to be extremely motivated, because turning up for injections probably every other month for something that they don't feel they're better as a result of it. You know, you'd need to be discussing it a lot with patients, showing them the scan results, maybe showing them their rate of progression before the injections and showing that for them it is slowing the rate of progression. Because I think that turning up for injections every other month or even possibly every month is a big imposition on people's time. And there's a risk of an infection getting in the eye every time we inject. Those are the similar sort of risks that we know about with any intravitreal injection. And then, of course, the specific drug risk of increasing the conversion to wet macular degeneration.
So hopefully when approval comes through in the UK, treatments are going to be delivered by the hospital eye service, but community optometrists will need to refer. They also need to know when to refer, as you've mentioned. So is it a good idea for optometrists now who have patients with geographic atrophy to start monitoring those patients, sort of looking for those key bits of data that would pinpoint progression or potential evidence of progression in the lead up to treatments becoming available?
So it's definitely a very good idea for community optometrists to understand the landscape and what may be coming up. Now, the best way we monitor rates of progression is using a test called fundus autofluorescence, and many optometrists in the community won't have that. Having said that, standard OCT examination is good at spotting areas of geographic atrophy, and one could look for areas of growth. But it may well be that what particularly the hospital eye service are looking for are just being informed about patients that already, you know, may meet the criteria for potential treatment. It may well be that in the first instance, the bit of monitoring and checking for progression is done in the hospital eye service. So we've got the autofluorescence tests and we can really track it accurately. But no question that these patients who have extrafoveal geographic atrophy, they're not normally referred to the hospital. So this would be a very, very significant change in pathways of referral. And in fact, having really close communication with your community optometrist is going to be key to success here. Ideally, one would have the ability to see the whole OCT and decide if reviewing them was needed or not.
Yes, because potentially there might be a lot of people out there who have got geographic atrophy, but because in the past we've known that actually there isn't any treatment for it, we've not bothered to inform the GP or not bothered to refer into the hospital eye service. So there might be actually quite a lot of people out there that you don't know about yet.
This is absolutely the case. The people we tend to see in the hospital are the people who've got poor vision, who've already got centre-involving disease, and it may be that NICE say that they're not eligible for treatment. So absolutely, utterly key is liaising with community optometrists. So already in our patch, we've done educational events with community optometrists explaining about how the landscape's changing. And obviously, we'll keep them very closely updated as well.
Okay, so the treatments are currently undergoing review by medical licensing bodies, but we're not sure when they'll get approved in the UK or even if they will be licensed at all. So when do you think we'll hear more?
I think that we will have some sort of licensing feedback early this year. And NICE then will be looking at that pretty quickly after that. So I think we'll know a lot more middle of 2024. That would be my hope and expectation.
And as well as these injections, are there any other promising treatments that might be coming out in the future that are perhaps only in the research stage at the moment?
So, as I mentioned, the complement pathway, there's a lot of research into other ways of affecting the complement pathway. So there are preparations currently in clinical research about oral preparations as well. And there'll be other modes of delivery potentially considered as well. So it isn't just a question of regular intravitreal injections. Of course, the downside if you give something orally is that it's potentially going to affect the whole body. So there could be side effects that may be less desirable, you know, as well. So the safety of that needs to be very carefully looked at. There have been a number of different avenues of investigation at other potential mechanisms in geographic atrophy. None of them have yet shown to be positive. And of course, a lot of patients ask us, is there anything that can restore treatment? So that's where the stem cell discussion comes in. And what I generally say to people is that that is still at a relatively early stage of research. So it's a long way from showing that that can restore vision. And so I don't think that there's anything likely that's going to be restorative to the retinal function in the nearish future.
And there is another treatment that's potentially becoming available where the treatment involves using red light. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So there's a lot of research going on in a number of units about the use of light therapy. I would say that actually it's extremely early days. My personal view, and that is the view of the College of Ophthalmologists as well with their AMD commissioning guidance, is that there is currently not sufficient evidence to be recommending that in widespread use.
Okay, that's really informative, and thank you very much, Claire.
Pleasure, thank you.
To check out the additional reading materials for this episode, head to the Docket website, dockets.info, and search for sound optometry. Don't forget that by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice and communication. We'll be back next month to discuss eye care in children with special educational needs following the next Docket webinar. See you then. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening.